Hi, everyone. Welcome. It is September 2nd, 2019. Happy Labor Day to all of you, and welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. I think one thing that's interesting for me about the history of these broadcasts is that when we first began them back in 2007, I believe it was, my thinking was that all of them were going to be question and answer, that I was just going to take questions that people had midweek, kind of a check-in or a support in between their therapist phone calls. And so with that, I started doing the Q&A, and then people were asking for topics. But this really was the original idea that we were going to have. So what we like to do is bring in the questions that are pre-submitted first. And for those of you who are joining us live, you can enter in any questions along the way. I don't have a moderator this evening, so I'm just going to kind of work it myself. So I'll get to the live questions once I finish the five or six questions that have been pre-submitted. So with that, question number one, isn't the idea of codependency just another way of saying it is the parent's fault? I think it can be interpreted that way. And one of the things that I find distasteful in the treatment field is this kind of blame shaming that therapists and treatment professionals do to parents. I mean, there's a couple of ways to discuss this. Number one, it's okay to be at fault. It's okay to take accountability and to be responsible. In fact, I think kind of the highest version of parenting is to admit that you and to know that you've dented your children. I tell the story of my mother when she came up to me after one of my talks, said, "I'm beginning to wonder if I shouldn't feel guilty for some of the things I did in raising you boys." And I said to my mother, "It's quite all right. In fact, it would be very wonderful if you were aware of the ways that you, the mistakes that you made, the ways that you dented us. But the guilt that you feel doesn't necessarily need to be there. In fact," I told her, "the guilt is going to get in the way of you being more aware of yourself." So I want to start with that it's okay to take responsibility and to realize your contribution. But the essence of codependency really is an idea of cause and effect, an oversimplification of it. In other words, it's okay to recognize your responsibility, the way that you've dented your children, and all of us dent our children. That's part of the conditions of being human. But the fact of the matter is that's still not a cause of their behavior. Right? I can hurt you. I can say something unkind to you. And how you cope with it, how you deal with it, is now yours. I think it's really important that we don't create this false dichotomy. And for me, what that means is that parents and children can have discussions where children talk about how parents hurt them. I think that's really important that you develop the capacity. But now the dents are the child's, right? The dents are theirs to work up, to work out. It doesn't exonerate you, remove the responsibility for going forward and growing up in your life. And this can happen from a young age. And I think, in fact, the more open the parent can be to it, the better. Something else I've been thinking about with codependency lately is codependency is a pop psychology term. It's not a clinical term. It's something that comes out of the addiction literature. The more scientific word would be poor attachment. That would be the more accurate or the deeper psychological term. And everybody has some attachment wounds. Of course, some are much worse than others, but everybody has them. Every parent is human. And because of that, none of them are perfect. And so even if there wasn't addiction, we could look at any number of people, any individual in the world, and look at and explore their quote-unquote codependency, right? The way in which they were taught, the way that it was demonstrated about their separation from others, their connection and separation to others. It's just about the quality of the relationship. Now, when we look at addiction and mental health and we start talking about codependency, we start there because a simple way to understand mental health and addiction issues is that it's a person medicating themselves, medicating trauma and attachment wounds, right? That's all it is. The messages, the wounds, the scar tissue we have around our attachment wounds. And so if we can begin to talk about how we felt about mother and father, how mother and father feel about Junior, right? How they over-identify with him, how they have an anxious attachment, how they drown in guilt and shame and blame. If we can begin to look at that, we can begin to really heal the wound at the root of the symptom. That's most important. Lastly, I'll tell you this story where I was teaching at a conference not too long ago where a therapist asked me, I was actually filling in for somebody and I was teaching about codependency, and somebody asked me the question. They said, Brad, I need you to reconcile or square this idea with me. How can I encourage the mother of, say, an addicted son? How can I encourage her to kick her son out of the house when the possible consequence is dire, is death, ultimately? And I said to her, I heard the problem in the thinking in her question. I said, don't ever tell a parent what to do, especially when the consequences of that direction are serious, right? You can give assignments, but nothing with such a potential impact on it, like kicking your son out of the house again. What you do with that mother is you help her understand her codependency and you help her to heal. That is, to heal her sense of self and well-being and the relationship issues that come out of that, that healed self and well-being. Then she decides what she does with her son, not you. And honestly, like I said many times, either decision, if it comes from a healthy place, are appropriate. And either decision, if it comes from a place of codependency, that is a place of unhealthy relationship, either decision is the wrong one. It's really about healing a core sense of yourself and how you see yourself relating to others. So that's the idea there. So thank you for that question if you're on. How do I know the difference? Next question. How do I know the difference between enabling and showing compassion, or what you call containing? I almost started answering this question during the last question. In fact, this question was given me orally recently by a parent. It's a very good one because there's this kind of curvilinear relationship that I see in treatment where in the early phases of treatment or psychoeducation, parents are in denial. They're rescuing and enabling. That is, they're participating in a dynamic with a child that tends to reinforce the negative behavior. That's the simplest definition. They're co-participating with the child in the disorder. And then we see a real heightened awareness, a kind of a vigilance on the part of the parent trying not to do those behaviors. And then we see something on the other side that some might argue looks like codependency. But it comes from a much more loving, courageous, authentic place. So you stop asking the question in the end, am I causing it or not? And you start showing up with what feels right to you. That's the biggest difference. There's a great line out of the book, The Letters of Juliet to the Knight in Rusty Armor, that my therapist wrote, where she says, I came to understand that I was not here to shape anybody up, to rearrange or shape anybody up for my own advantage. And I think about that mantra. The goal is to show up in a relationship authentically, courageously, with love and with compassion, also with a sense of self, meaning that I know my limitations and I own them. And if I need a timeout or a break or to step away from my dynamic, I do it because that's what I need, right? That's what showing up looks like. Whether or not it causes or cures, the question of cause is really the problem. The idea that you can control another human being, that's the problem. So you let go of control. You let go of fixing. You let go of managing. And ironically, not only do you free yourself up of painful anxiety and depression and drama and trauma, not only do you free yourself up from those issues and feelings, but you also create a more optimal environment for the people that you love. Both things happen. Now, listen, I say a more optimal environment. I don't say one that is absolutely guaranteed to cure or to change anybody. That's not the thing. But you're a healthier person, so your contribution is more healthy. So that's a great question. Next question. If we are supposed to let go of outcomes, why send a child to treatment? These are kind of building on each other. This next question is, you do it because it's the right thing to do. You do it because you want to send your child a message. You want to provide an opportunity for healing, for a new context, right? A respite from the storm that they themselves might be creating for themselves. And that's what you do. But at the same time, it's this kind of magically ironic thing that you do, which is you let go. But we don't have experience with that. Like a lot of things in mental health, we just don't have experience. I will say something very bold, and I've witnessed this over the years of doing adult intensives. Most people don't know what it would sound like if a capable, loving, patient, authentic, clear-minded adult showed up. They just don't know what it sounds like. We do these role plays where you go back and you talk to your parents and you talk to your siblings, you talk to even your younger self. And I'm always curious, I'll ask clients on occasion, not all the time, what do you want to hear? What would you want to hear from your parents? This happened at a recent one. And they'll give a version that sounds relatively kind, relatively warm. And then I offer just a little tweak to it. Say, what if your parent was to say this? And I have the person playing the role say this thing. And so often, somebody says that would feel a lot better. We don't know what it's like for somebody to show up in the ways that I described because we've never seen it. And most of us, don't have overtly abusive and cruel parents. We don't. Some might, but most of us don't. We have parents that had the best of intentions, but were very human. And so it's more subtle, which makes it, in a way, more insidious. It takes that therapy lens, that deeper dive, to kind of pull it apart and to hear what we were really being told about ourselves and the world. So I'm digressing a little bit, but you do it because it's the right thing to do. And the right thing to do means it's what your heart believes in. The same way that you would tell somebody something kind or loving, you do it not to try to manipulate how they feel. You do it because it's an expression of your love. You do it because the means is the end. It's an expression of your attempt to give your child something that they weren't getting at home. Something other, something different, something unique, in a safe, contained place. That's why you do it. And you learn all along. And sometimes children help you learn this more than others by resisting, by struggling in treatment. So those children really do well to teach their parents that you've got to let go of outcomes. Some of my most, I would say, difficult and spiritual experiences with parents that I've worked with in the last 25 years have been with those children who have struggled the most, because the parents have been in a sort of master class on letting go. The next question, this one, here we go back down to maybe one of the two or three most commonly asked questions. How is the length of stay determined? I'm going to say it a little bit different than I usually do. It's determined by you. If your child is an adult, it's also determined by them. That's the simple answer. And what, you know, I've worked with therapists. I've been working with therapists now in my professional capacity for almost a few decades. But I've had various therapists. My wife and I were talking about this last night. I've had various therapists at different times for my children, different family therapists. I've had my own therapist for more than 20 years. And there's one indication of a bad therapist, and that is when they get very directive and advicey with you. It's a little bit different with parent coaching, right? There can be a little bit more coaching, but I'm talking about traditional therapy. And that should be inherent in some of this process. It's just telling you what your options are. Whenever somebody starts talking about length of stay, I talk about all the factors involved. Why it might be shorter, why it might be longer. What are we trying to accomplish? Right? What are the objectives? Why might a parent be asking that? Are they looking to have them come home? Are they missing them? Are they feeling guilty? Are they afraid the child isn't going to forgive them? Is it a financial issue? Right? That's a practical, pragmatic issue that has to be considered. Is it some kind of emotional blackmail between the child and the parent? I remember one time, I was thinking about this just today, I had a parent say about their adult child, I'm going to take them home after this. And the reason I'm going to take them home is because last time we sent them away, which was to a college, everything fell apart. So I'm going to take them home this time so that won't happen. And I said, let's pick that apart a little bit. It sounds like you're saying that if he comes home or she comes home, that you can guarantee, because you can oversee things, that you can guarantee that they're not going to fall apart. And I think there's a thinking in that that is a problem. If this parent had said to me, I'm ready for him or her to come home, I'm ready for the challenge, I hope I can be supportive, I think we're ready to kind of experiment with this again, those are all different than I'm going to make sure this time that it doesn't fall off the rails. So it's really the why. Really, when we talk about why, we're revealing our codependency or our lack of it, our healthy attachment or our lack of it. That's what we're doing. And if we're still struggling with our attachment issues to the extent that it's coming out in simple explanations like that, then we have work to do there. Right? We work with a therapist to say, I see my child as a reflection of myself. I see myself responsible for my adult child's success or failure. I feel tremendous guilt and fear and anxiety, and I try to control things. So I don't want anybody to get hurt. We start to reveal our sense of what it means to be a self and to love somebody else. So length of stay is determined by you, and the therapist is supposed to coach and guide you around that. Now, sometimes the reasons that length of stay are discussed by a parent, it becomes obvious really quickly to the therapist what it's rooted in, what the discussion is rooted in. And that's why they might be tempted to lean to advice. But what I've realized in working with my children and their therapists at home over the last decade or so is that the ones that give me advice with the idea that if I follow the advice that I can fix everything, that's not good therapy. It's not good therapy. And the implication is really just that it's all up to me, that if I show up a certain way, I can have a guaranteed outcome. And it's crazy. It's nonsense. But it comes out sometimes in the way that the therapists talk about it, or anybody, or we talk about it. I put these series of questions. This came from one person. I put these next three questions as a series because they all relate to each other. The three questions go like this. How do I know if a therapist is helping and if he or she is right for me? How can I find someone who can get at the root of my problems? And am I right to ask these questions? You absolutely are. And frankly, my first response is, if you ask these questions and your therapist is not at least attempting to understand you, if you don't feel better for having asked these questions, it's a sign you don't have an adequate therapist. I'm beginning to become biased towards therapists that are a little bit older, right? With more experience, of course, because it takes a while for us to kind of learn what it is, what this art is about. I think one of the ways that you know if you have an adequate therapist, that if you express some anger, frustration, disappointment, some uncomfortable feelings towards them, which is really risky to do. The adequate therapist will respond with gratitude and compassion and admiration for your courage, and probably apologize for some misstep or mistake. But if they spin it and make it about you and your issues, you know you have an inexperienced and insecure therapist. I don't put a lot of weight on therapists who label themselves with a certain theory. It's a way to kind of hide behind what is a critical aspect of therapy, like the self of the therapist. My wife told me that she asked one of our children's therapists how many children that therapist had. And there was a very cold and formal wall, which is actually something they teach you in graduate school sometimes because the professors don't know any better. And the therapist said, why are you asking? And my thinking was, it's an easy answer. You just tell them how many kids you have and how old they are. Because the rigidness of that therapist and her inability to ask the question, it demonstrated that she thought she had to be right. There are therapists who don't have any children. There are therapists who have been through a lot of what you've been through. But the fact of the matter, if they don't have the perspective that I don't know your truth, that I'm not here to tell you how to live, but here to support you in a process that helps you figure out what's right for you, you have a problem with that therapist, right? There's a problem in that process. So if I don't think that I am a guru and know everything, my answer is going to be pretty simple and straightforward. I'm aware and generous with my potential biases and blind spots, not defensive of them, not defensive of the projection that you might have. In fact, if you said to me, well, you have never had a kid with autism spectrum disorder, for example, my response would be, you're right. I do not know what that's like. That's why I can't tell you what to do. I can talk about some general ideas and principles, some situations that have worked for me that as I've gone through my own challenges, but they may or may not apply to you. That's up for you to decide. So I wrote a couple of things about this because this is passion. My next book that I just finished last week and is being edited by somebody else now, ready for its final draft. I talk about finding an adequate therapist, and I've written a couple of articles on this before. One was a blog, and I've put the link here. You can just Google Brad Reedy and what to look for in a therapist if you're listening on the podcast. I also co-authored a paper, a more scholarly version of it, with my wife that showed up in the NatSap Journal. And the article for that, if you want to Google, if you're not looking at the link right now on the screen, if you're listening to the podcast version, just Google Brad Reedy and psychology versus therapy, and then click on the NatSap link. And both talk about this idea that the shift from a therapist who is anxious to fix you versus the therapist that's eager to understand you. See, we think we need this kind of schoolmaster to slap our hands, to shape us up, because that's all we knew, most of us. That's how we were taught that people learn. But an adequate therapist is patient. An adequate therapist is something different than a schoolmaster or a parent, ideally. An adequate therapist responds with curiosity instead of anxiety, curiosity instead of fear or shame. Curiosity that says you must have a good reason. I was just talking to my publisher today. You must have a good reason. No matter how depraved your behaviors are, you must have a good reason for this. So those are my answers. And you're not only okay to ask this question, it's important to ask them. And if you can't have this dialogue with your therapist and feel better afterwards, it might be time to look for a new therapist. Frankly, and I know this sounds a little bit strange, maybe even self-promoting, print up the articles and have them read them. Pay them for the time, but say, hey, if this lines up with you, this is what I've been thinking. This is what I've been learning. What do you think about this? And some of the stuff that I write is pretty indicting. because there's really only one way to respond to a client who's getting upset with you, and that is in a welcoming, kind, nurturing, understanding, potentially even apologetic way. Anything else is not therapy. It's something else. And if you're too much for the therapist because you have too many feelings, that's okay too. They're just human. Then find somebody who can contain you. All right, I'm happy to take live questions. Like I said, I don't have a moderator this morning, so I'm going to read to you the questions, and then I am going to just answer them. First question that's coming live. What do you say when someone not in your circle asks where your son is? Is there a sentence that lets them politely know what happened, but it's not up for discussion? Vague is the best way. Where he was having some struggles, and we sent him away to a school. We are technically a school. The adolescents are called students, in fact. So keep it as vague as you would like. We're working on, he's in this experience, he's having this experience where we're learning how to deal with some things. Just keep it vague. The people that are your people will respect your boundaries. The people that aren't, doesn't matter what you say. And again, I love this question because what it reminds me of is that we just do not have a lot of experience with people who have healthy boundaries and capacity. We don't. It's not in abundance. This process that I'm describing, this process that you're involved in, it is the exceptional. It is the rare. It's not the commonplace. Thank you for that. Great question. Next question. Who should be in touch with my daughter besides my husband and I? That's not one size fits all kind of answer. So ask your child's therapist. I typically, and this is a kind of a general answer, is it starts off with the primary parents, whoever those are. Could be a step parent involved in that also. Then we may expand to siblings. That can happen in the first couple of weeks sometimes when a sibling wants to write one of those early letters, those kind of a hopes and intentions type of letter. Sometimes that expands to positive friends. Sometimes it even expands to friends who might not be positive. It can get that far because we want to experiment with what that's like, right? How are they writing? How are they talking? How are they? We want to see their thinking. So mom and dad or step-parents or primary parents or grandparents first, right? Whoever's the guardian. Expanding to siblings, aunts, uncles, and grandparents, if appropriate, if there's an intention behind it, and then expanding beyond that. That's going to be the exception. We don't want to go too fast with that, depending upon the depth and the quality of the work that's happening with the parenting group, with the guardians. We may move slower or quicker to expand. So there's no one right answer. It's a great question. It just can't be answered generically because it's different for everybody. So thanks for asking that. But as always, you get to ask your evoked therapist the thinking behind it. Why or why not? I think you deserve to ask those questions and have them answered intelligently. Next question, how do you assimilate back into normal life after evoke? For example, sleeping in bed, meals, showers, getting dressed, etc. Out in the field, those things are secondary and not applicable, but back home, there's perhaps worry about appearance, diet, and the rest. Yeah, assimilation is difficult. You know, my therapist told me this one time that once you've been in analysis, you don't really want to talk to other people that haven't been in analysis. And once you've been in this experience as a parent or a student or a client, sometimes the discussions that we used to have don't make sense anymore. Some of the assimilation back is easy and less complicated, but it's hard to, how do you explain? You know, when I work with parents who go through a serious mental health or addiction issue with their child, 2, 3, 4 years out, you can't explain that to somebody in 2 or 3 minutes, right? It doesn't make sense. The words you use, it's like when I went to Switzerland for my 50th birthday and I took pictures of the Alps. And the minute I would look at the picture that I just took, I thought, that's not the same thing. Like sitting here and looking at, no matter what kind of camera, no matter how well I did, I just can't capture what the feeling is. And that's the same experience is going through something as intimate and as deeply personal as what you and your child are going through. So just knowing that and making sure that you have somebody in your life. For me, it's a therapist. It could be a sponsor, a mentor. It could be a group of friends. I know people have created friend groups and support groups around this. I've got to find that place. I've got to find my people. And they're not everywhere. And that's okay. Not everybody needs to have a shared experience with me. But I need someone. And that becomes my base. Right? Isn't that true for a lot of us in a lot of different ways in life? So thank you for that. Next question. My son finished the program recently, and when he's frustrated, he jokes about me sending him away. I don't want to defend the decision, but I say yes, and I think our entire family function is functioning better. I hope you do too. Does that sound unkind since he did the hard field work, but we all benefited? I still feel a little bit guilty that he lost the summer. First off, you have my compassion, okay? So just know that. Second off, you said it. The guilt is causing the defense. If you can go along with the joke, means you're not defended. If you can exaggerate the joke and say something like, I wish you could send me away sometimes, that could help the problem just as much, right? Or maybe I should go away this time. If you can roll with it, right? That lets your son, first of all, lets him be him, but it also demonstrates you've worked through the guilt, which is you know, that's the part about compassion I have, is it the response of the explanation is the issue. What's the difference? I used to always ask my staff this question. What's the difference between a defense, right? A justification and an explanation. And I would talk about various ways, and it comes down to this. A defense or a justification comes from a feeling of being threatened by something, some judgment, right? There's a feeling of threat there. An explanation has none of that energy. One of the signs of whether it's a defense and a justification versus an explanation, that if somebody cuts you off mid-sentence, if it's an explanation, your response will be, okay, I don't need to explain it. It's easy to let go of, it's easy to drop it. If it's a defense or a justification, it's going to be harder for you to let go of if somebody stops you mid-sentence or disagrees or interrupts you. So if it's easy not to say it, it's an explanation, because then it's not coming from that need to defend. If it's hard to let it go and not say it, it's coming because of a defense. So then it's just your issue, right? And we all have these all the time. And it takes a while to understand the defense, to understand the wound, to understand the trauma that we feel, and to work through it. And as we do, we have responses that aren't what we call trauma responses, and we have responses that are based more on our capacity, greater bandwidth. Thank you. Next question says, can you talk about the interplay between mental health challenges and accountability awareness? As a parent, I struggle with understanding what expectations are reasonable and appropriate for my child with mental health challenges. I don't want to view them through the victim lens, but nor do I want to have expectations that are not reasonable to meet. That is a really good and hard question. I just finished the book I told you. Chapter one is kind of the heroic journey extended. Chapter two is what it means to be a self. And chapter three is what it means to love another. And it's the question that you ask is so hard because it's a very personal question. It's the difference between trying to be right and trying to be you. In trying to be right, in many ways, is the opposite of being a you, being a human, being a self, being a person. And again, we weren't raised, we weren't cooked in the soup, if you will, of being a self or a person or human. We weren't taught how to be human. We were taught how to be right and good. And they thought that was the project. And we don't blame them because that's what they were taught. And it made sense to them because they thought if you learn to be good and right, good things happen. You develop morals, right? That's what they thought. That's what we were told. But when you learn to be a self, when you learn to be a human, a person, a you, you really develop a different kind of a higher level of morality. Things then operate out of love. And self-care need not be compromised. So the answer, it's a hard question. I encourage you to buy the book when it comes out. But the hard question is, who are you? And really, that's a lifelong question and journey, isn't it? One of the stories I tell in the book is, after grappling with something around parenting not too long ago, I said to my therapist, I knew I was in trouble because I used the word should. I said, shouldn't I? And I heard myself and I said, isn't it ideal that I do this thing? And she said, so simply, she said, I think it's ideal that you're just you. And I thought, how could I have forgotten that? Just be me. Plato said, in the ideal society, there would be one law. And that was that everybody was themselves. So the answer to your question is in your higher self, your most authentic self. And it's the boundary that you get to set. And you don't get to be right. You do not, in this way of thinking, you don't get to be right anymore. You get to be a person. You get to be a self. And it is so much better to be a self and to be a person. I want to say this just in case there's any lack of clarity or understanding. I know this because I've been doing it wrong for 49 years. 50, I should say 51 because I'm 51. I was going to give myself credit for the last two, but that would be a lie. I've been doing it wrong. I'm better than I was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but I've been doing it the other way. I've been doing it to my children. I've been doing it to myself. We talk about that as a family all the time. I've created a culture about who's right and who's wrong. And so when I talk and when I teach about this, it comes from intimate experience of how harmful it is and how suffocating it is to live that way. So thank you guys for the questions. Thank you all for the questions. I'm going to go through upcoming announcements, and then if there are any live questions by the end of those, then I'll take those. As always, upcoming parent support groups. I will be in New York City on September 9th, London on October 6th, and in Chicago on October 27th. We're also going to be, I'm sorry, I forgot this again. I'm going to be in the Bay Area, the South Bay Area, San Mateo, on September 16th. So I'll be in the Bay Area on September 16th, also 7 to 9 p.m. at the Marriott. Email melanie@evoketherapy.com for more information or to RSVP. Any questions about any of those upcoming parent support groups. We have a Finding You intensive. The next one is full. The one after that, October 23rd through 27th. Best thing you can do for yourself and your family and your children. If you want to do an outdoor adventure trip with your children, your young adult wants to reconnect with nature, think of Therapy Light or Sober Fun. We have Pursuits Adventure Trips that combine fun activities all over the world and some of the therapeutic ideas that we talk about and teach. 12-step support groups, we ask all parents to attend 6 of these while their child is with us. So any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, or Families Anonymous. AdultChildren.org is a great place to go to find out kind of what you were taught as a child. How was your environment, healthy or not? Alateen is a group for teenagers of people suffering from addiction and mental health. Recovery.org is a Buddhist-inspired recovery program, less focus on a higher power. The National Alliance on Mental Illness also holds chapters, local groups in your area of support services that are free or affordable. Follow us on social media. You can listen to all of these broadcasts through the podcast app on an iPhone or iOS device by using the podcast app, on an Android device using the SoundCloud app, or on your computer, go to soundcloud.com. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find Evoke Therapy programs using the handle @EvokeTherapy. You can find the Summit Lodge by using the handle @EvokeSummitLodge on Instagram. On Facebook, you can find Evoke by searching Evoke Therapy programs. The Alumni Foundation is a group of alumni parents that try to raise money to help people that can't afford therapy. Go to Facebook and search Evoke Family Foundation. Our blog, of course, on our website has new information each week. My first book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is available on Amazon.com. If you go through the Parent Alumni Foundation book phase, a percentage of the proceeds goes to help people that can't afford therapy. So, all right, looks like no other live questions have come in. So I hope these points of contact are helpful. This Thursday night, I'm going to be talking about autism spectrum disorder. So please join us for that. I hope this is a nice midweek point of contact with all of you. We'll try to hold these Q&As for families, grandparents, uncles, aunts, family, friends, siblings, so that people can ask questions every 5 or 6 weeks or so. So you can also look in our library of archived webinars, our podcasts, and listen to some of the old ones. Thank you for joining me this evening, and I'll see you Thursday night. Bye-bye.